There were bones in everything, especially the women whose hands were full of them, whose hands fed the fire under the pot with many forests and turned the spoon in the stock like a key.
Listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello, this is Jennifer Williams, Programme Manager at the Scottish Poetry Library, and this podcast is being recorded at the Stanza International Poetry Festival 2014 and in association with that festival. And I'm so delighted to be sitting here in the Beyer Theatre with the poet Jacob Polley, who I saw read many years ago in Edinburgh and thought he was fabulous. And so it's been so wonderful to see him progress in his career. And Jacob's had three books of poetry out, all with Picador, The Brink, Little Gods, and The Havocs. And he also has written a novel called Talk of the Town, which came out in 2009. He's won many, many awards. We're going to get to hear from him about his poetry now. So we'll start with the first poem.
Smoke. My father kept a stove with dog's legs on a pink hearthstone. One morning he climbed down the icy stairs and spread his palms on the blood-warm metal flanks. He cranked open the iron doors like a black bank safe, but found no heat and ash heaped in its place. He cracked grey whittled coals, released brief blue flames, and knocked down his soot through the bars of the grate. The ash pan, softly loaded, and almost as wide as a doorway, he carried like dynamite through the dark house, his bright face blown with smuts. At the back door, he slid the ash into a tin dustbin, then snapped sticks, crumpled newspaper, struck a match, and dipped it between the kindling. Smoke unrolled, flames spread, the rush of the stove eating air started up, and my father would shake on rocks from an old coal hod and swing the door shut. But this time he took a book, broke its spine, and slung that on instead. His diaries, year by year, purred as their pages burned, their leather boards shifted, popped, and fell apart. Soon I would arrive, pulled from under my mother's heart, and grow to watch my father break the charred crossbeam of a bird from the flue, wondering if I too had hung in darkness and smoke, looking up at the light let down her throat whenever my mother sang or spoke.
I feel like one of the amazing things about that poem is that it seems like it's going along one track, and then there's this sort of shift, and this quite feels like an exciting change of gear, and the images at the end are very potent and explode almost out of the poem. I guess I'm curious about this being...
Oh no, you're not going to ask me to remember how I wrote it, are you?
Is it a true story?
It's one of those things. I think the poem maybe acknowledges it too. It feels like a memory, but it might not be. It's part of a memory that almost becomes a kind of personal legend or something like that. So I don't know whether it's true or not. Mm-hmm. I think it's the best way to say it. It doesn't seem terribly important. You know, I suppose it's a kind of...
Poets are allowed to make things up.
Yeah, poets are totally allowed to make things up, yes. It's that old, the old thing about, to tell a lie to be more, to get to a kind of deeper truth, really, I suppose. It was a poem I wrote many years ago now, and at the time, I can remember, it's funny because you don't really remember the content of the poem. When you look back at writing, you remember the kind of furious, intricate struggle to get the get the get the lines right and find a kind of form for it. Those three line verses, it took me a long time to kind of find that three line verse form for it, and to feel all right about it, you know, to feel all right that there were short lines and long lines, mm-hmm. and that it worked, and that the poem should be written for breath, really, for speaking, as of course, you know, many poems are, you know, they're not written according to some cookie cutter kind of shape. They're written according to how it feels they might be spoken, and that was, there's something important about that poem for me in my writing life, I suppose, that I came to that through that poem, you know, I came to that feeling about the way that the poem ought to be arranged through writing the poem.
Mm. They do feel, I think your poem's voice is one of the very noticeable aspects of them. They feel very crafted, they feel very honed and crafted and formed, and that there's been very careful attention to the, I think that the breaks in of the line and you can feel the space around the poem holding it on the page. And what is your kind of practice like? Do you take time, do you edit over a period of time? Do you read them out loud to yourself?
I hope, or I think, that my practice kind of changes, or I try to kind of keep it, I don't know, I'm thinking about things like, I'm trying to find a metaphor for it, like, you know, when you see lava fields, you see a volcano and you see a lava field and you see the lava right at its edge is still moving, you know, but behind it it's hardening and it's the crust has kind of formed. And I like to kind of feel a bit like that, really, that I'm trying to, I mean, certainly things like line endings or line breaks or however you want to put it, is this lifelong. I think there's a lifelong engagement with just where the line, one line ends and another begins. It just seems endlessly fascinating and interesting and a source of little perceptual shifts and jumps, and there's a whole system of comprehending and paying attention to the world in the line ending. So I feel like that's what I'm doing, really. I feel like that's what I'm trying to do, is to kind of keep live that kind of sense of exploring, really, and pushing that. But in terms of writing, I try to write quite quickly. You know, I write drafts of poems quite quickly. Because I like to have a sense that it's there, it's all been expressed, it's all kind of got out onto the page, and then I leave it, and then I go back, and I try to leave it for as long as possible, and then go back very ruthlessly and begin the real work, you know, of rearranging and moving things, and I try to keep that very fluid, as I tell my students, you know, keep everything very fluid and jelly-like. Don't kind of set anything too quickly. Mm. Be prepared to move something from right at the end to right to the beginning, you know, be absolutely open to that possibility. Mm. So, but my initial process is quite, I try to write a draft quite quickly because that's the best bit, you know, it's the most fun, it's the bit where you feel like you're improvising and you have the freedom of a really kind of improvisatory practice, you know. There's something thrilling and exciting about that, about casting something onto the page and getting to the end of it, you know, like a gesture that a visual artist makes with a brush or something, you know, a broad stroke that's comes out of the body, you know, and I like to feel that the poems come out of the body, come out of the mouth and the breath, and the obviously the fingers on the keyboard or the fingers around the pen as well. So I like that, but then I'll spend loads of time just trying to get whatever it is right. But I'll find often that if something isn't, I mean, there's also a, there's quite a ruthless motive as well for doing that, in that I think if I write something and I write from the beginning to the end, I can usually tell whether it's any good, you know, whether it's got any, if it's still kind of crackly, and if it's not, I can get rid of it, and I've not there's not much lost there, you know. Mm-hmm. I've not spent that long getting it out and onto the page. So there's no loss, you know. It's not like I've spent 6 months writing this thing line by line and then I've got to the end and realised it has no... And in order for it to kind of pass that test, it's something to do with... it has to still be kind of vibrating with life, with liveness. It has to have not quite got captured everything. And it has to be not too... It has to have been written in a way that isn't too mechanistic or something like that. It's not too much like what are they called? Hot when you play hopscotch, you know, and you jump from square to square. It's not got to feel like that, you know, that you've jumped from one to two to one to two, and then you've got to the end, and you know, it's got to feel the opposite of that, really. It's got to feel like it's still there were jumps that you didn't make or that you might still make. And you know, and you may still write, you know, I may still write a new middle section or a new beginning or a new whatever, but I've got to have made the kind of the initial gesture, I think.
The American poet Marie Howe, who I met a couple of years ago, I had a brother who had told her that each next line should be a surprise to her. And I thought that was a lovely way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
It sounds like something similar to what you're talking about, that it's not, that next step isn't completely obvious before you've got there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what went from when the father breaks the book in this poem, and suddenly it's very, to me, kind of unexpected, everything that happens from then on. And I think it's interesting as well, the rhymes at the end feel very, you really hear them ringing at the end, but then actually there's quite a lot of rhyme all through it, but it's quieter somehow. Do you enjoy using rhyme? Is that something that you would do consciously, or does that again happen quite sort of instinctively, depending on the poem?
It's partly to do with that lovely idea that you've just mentioned about each line being a surprise to the writer, and then it can be a surprise for the reader. And I tend to think of rhyme that way too. That it's a kind of, it's both a surprise and, you know, obviously the fact that the third line rhymes with the first comes as both as a surprise and a kind of comfort or the fulfillment of an expectation or something like that you didn't even really know was there. You didn't realise that you were expecting it, but your expectation is met, you know, and I like that, you know. So there's something very interesting there, I think, and I tend to use rhyme during my writing process in order to find often the next line, or, you know, in a very opportunistic way. Certainly in my earlier work, anyway, it's much more opportunistic, and the rhyme schemes are much less tied up, and there isn't a kind of scheme there that I'm working to or hoping that I'll. Or trying to kind of make the work fit. It's very much a kind of opportunistic process. And that's part of, I mean, that's got to be part of being a poet, really, having that ear for chimes and echoes and the sense that the oral matter of the poem is intimately related to its kind of imagistic content as well. I think that you're somehow trying to weld sound to objects and events and people and things happening.
Do you have poets that you love or that you would cite as don't know, poets you read that then make you want to write poems?
I've got that same kind of shifting, probably carousel of poets. I think you're always on the lookout for. I'm always on the lookout for new poets, and that doesn't mean necessarily, you know, new poets as in young poets or poets that have just published a book or something like that. But I'm looking for poets from history or from 30 years ago or that I maybe haven't come across. So I'm always on the lookout for new inspirations and new. I was going to say sources, which makes it sound as if I'm. You know, you're using other people's work or something, but I very much feel that the history of poetry and the poetry of other people, that's a source to that should be a source to any writer's work, really. I've got that same flipping carousel or roster of poets as probably many people. I started off, loving people like, Wilfred Owen's. Poetry made a big impact when I was a boy at school, along with Shakespeare's plays. I loved people, or I was intrigued by people like John Berryman. When I got a little bit older, I read his Dream Songs as a kind of, they were kind of intoxicating, partly because I didn't really understand them, and I didn't think that was any impediment really. To me enjoying them and imbibing something of that uncanny, kind of strange atmosphere. And I was aware that they were American and that he was an American poet, and so there were lots of things in it that were probably about America that I didn't really understand. And when people refer to a sea as a roebuck catalogue and things like that in an American poet, I'm still not quite sure what that means. I'm not thinking of Berryman there, but I'm thinking of another poem. I can't remember who it was by. So there was that kind of sense that was very exciting for me to read. And there's something really very basic about that as well, isn't it? That you're reading, vocabulary that you're not familiar with quite, or brand names that you don't really know. And their poems are containers for those as well. And that comes as a kind of interesting. As a surprise and a thrill. There were those people, and then people like Elizabeth Bishop, and after Berryman, people like Richard Wilbur and James Wright, and Emily Dickinson and Adrian Rich, and that whole kind of American W.S. Merwin and people like that. And it wasn't like I was absorbed in poetry from a young age or anything like that. I wasn't. I went to a smallish secondary school. There wasn't. I didn't know poets were alive still. And there are many people who say that. That and this was before, believe it or not. Before the internet and things like that. So you couldn't just look things up. So I was dependent on my school library, and I was dependent on. My public library in Carlisle, and that's where I went for books from a very, my mum took me to the library from a very young age, the public library and things like that. So I've kind of stumbled my way, towards, reading and towards poems particularly.
When did you first start writing poems? Can you remember?
I was a teenager, when many teenagers want that short, brief, expressive power, the expressive power of the tiny poem, and the sense that it's something that springs out of emotion, and I think that's what it is for teenagers, isn't it? Something like that, kind of slightly romantic as well. So I started writing then. Probably along with every teenager ever, but it was there were other reasons too. I think there were kind of personal reasons for me writing poems, and it came right to the point when you're kind of slightly you're like 14, 15, so you're becoming a little bit more fluent. You're beginning to look at, you begin to look at Shakespeare at school. You're in that kind of year at school. You've maybe begun to get, you know, you're in. Well, when I was at school, it was sets. You know, you're in set one or set two or set three, depending on your ability. You know, so maths. You know, I was good at English, and all of a sudden there's a bit more time. You know, you're looking at bigger books and more difficult, in inverted commas, books. So there was that, and you know, things that meant that there were difficult things happening in my, for me, kind of personally. So I was looking for a way, I think, to voice those things, or have some kind of, actually not voice those things, but actually externalize them and have some control over how I felt, you know. And maybe that's it with teenagers as well. That's what you're looking to do. You're looking to kind of out of the great cyclonic life, you know, life yeah. of a very dramatic life of the teenager. Maybe some of that whirl and cyclone needs to be the desire to have that out of the self and into something. And I used to, you know, I thought I would go to art college and things like that. You know, painting and drawing wow. and things were my what I was thought I'd do.
Oh, but, I didn't know that.
But there's too much stuff. You know? There's too there are too many brushes to clean and you know, things like that. So writing was immediately much.
Very portable, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very portable, much easier. You know? I was also kind of lazy, I think, you know. So the idea that you could just have a notebook, you know, and a pen, you know, was a real, you know, really good for me at that time. So, so all drawing and painting and kind of fell by the wayside, and it was writing really that took off for me.
Shall I have another poem?
Yeah, sure. Folktale. Behind us were the dead and many forests, the sowing and the cooking, the cloudless stocks and the long life bread that was beautiful like a river stone when worn to a polish by the children's doing without. On the table was the sundial of a loaf. In the middle of the day was the hub of a loaf, and the days turned, wood went to smoke, or to spoons, or tables. The spoons went black. The hands that turned the spoons in the blackening pot blackened in the smoke. There were bones in everything, especially the women whose hands were full of them, whose hands fed the fire under the pot with many forests and turned the spoon in the stock like a key. The men dug for miles, getting nowhere. On the wind they blunted shovels, billhooks, picks and scythes, and the earth was seized, a lock the men likened themselves to in jokes and then turned into. The valuables, the preservatives, salt and memory, though anyone might choose a river pebble and keep it in the mouth and habit here wore stone to a kind of worth that was passed on and on from mouth to mouth, like a word that could not be said, but fooled the mouth by filling it with what came to be called true bread.
That's really got that ending like a kind of fable or something. You get the...
I don't know why I wrote it, or I really don't know. And that seems kind of quite important in many ways. There wasn't, you know, I hadn't really been thinking about. I think I'd started to write something else, and it's often the way, I think, with me anyway. And I try to talk to my students about this too. You know, you must start. You must begin. You must put some things down on the page, because even if what you're putting down is kind of unpromising, It might just provide the kind of trampoline surface, the kind of leap that allows you to find something else. And you won't find that something else unless you go through the crust, the other stuff that you've been kind of labouring to get out and not really enjoying very much and wondering where it's going. So I think I was writing something else. but oh, I wish I brought like a book or a notebook or something like that. I don't think I've even got a notebook with this stuff in.
We were just doing some work at the library around Paul Muldoon, doing some reading groups with Paul's poems, and I thought, I better try and understand what's going on here. So I read a great interview with him and was sort of relieved in a way, because he spoke a lot about, I thought in a very beautiful way, about the fact that he doesn't know anything, which obviously is not true, but I think it is his way of saying the more he learns, the more he realizes that knowing is not, it's probably not something you could ever really do on some level, and that we don't spend, I think we have a lot of systems where we think, we convince ourselves we understand everything that's going on, science and mathematics and even language, you know, we have all these signs pointing to everything, but is that really knowing what this, you know, table is, that I can say, name it, you know, and I think he was talking about that being, trying to find a way to become more comfortable with not knowing and with, you know, a way of writing from an unconscious place rather than having to start with an idea or even with an image, maybe, you know, maybe it's a sound, maybe it's what you're talking about, that, you know, that gesture, the breath coming out of you. And I think that, you know, I find that as well, that it's when I can turn off the grocery list part of my brain that I think you access something that's much more in your center and much more original, actually.
Intention as well. I think intention is tricky when it comes to writing poems. And maybe not so much with prose, you know, but I think if you have, it's dangerous, for me anyway, it's dangerous for my poems, for the poems that I haven't written, for me to have an intention.
Yeah.
That's very, you know, almost impossible then to write something that kind of lives and is contains a kind of weirdness or a kind of rattle of unexpectedness. You know, I'm trying to kind of cut in my practice. I'm trying to cultivate that as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lack of intention, really, which is allowing you something else, something that isn't your as Paul Muldoon, as he always does, as probably so beautifully puts it, you know, that you're not writing out of what you know, but you're writing out of and towards what you don't know.
I love this when, again, I feel like there's a kind of, for me, this turning point in the poem, a surprise. There are bones in everything. And somehow at that point, I'm still thinking about soup or something, you know, kind of cooking, and then especially the women whose hands were full of them. And then there's this completely startling going into the interior of someone's body that is, I don't know if it's because it's called folktale, but somehow I suddenly was in a fairy tale world almost where things are very much not what they seem. It's very effective. How do you choose your titles? Do they come, do they come after?
Yeah, they come, you know, afterwards, and they change, and I mean, a title has to do something very odd. They're almost, I was talking to someone the other day and talking about the idea of, I was just groping towards the idea perhaps that the poem kind of hangs a bit like an amulet or a pendant off this title. So it's the kind of art, you know, it's the thing, it's the artifact, it's the object or the thing that's infused with significance is hanging from this title. So the title is so important, and, you know, rather like the chain that might kind of set or the setting of the setting itself of an amulet, it seems very important that you get that kind of title right, that it has the right kind of relationship, which might not be quite direct, you know, it's not of the same material necessarily, but it's of a material that kind of sets off the, it's not telling the reader how to read the poem, it's just showing relationships, or it's choreographing as much as it can kind of significances. I think that's what we're doing when we're writing poems as well. we're choreographing, we're trying to adjust and change significances. That's what we're working with, you know. We're working with language, of course, but we're working with significances. And I think that the title is this big, the big significance that you're adjusting and changing and trying to kind of get right. And Folktale just seemed, it seemed to be what the poem what kind of was, you know, so it seemed right, and it seemed to have a kind of distance that I wanted to, you know. I didn't want it to be called, I don't know, Bread or Tree Bread or something like that. I wanted it to be almost, you know, like a woodblock print.
Yeah.
That kind of very, very, I mean, they're very beautiful and can be very complex, but, you know, for me, kind of black and white, bold, straight, kind of straight lines, you know, dark forest, you know, white pinny or whatever. I wanted it to have that sense, I think. So it's like a kind of woodblock poem almost.
Yes, I think you get that sense. One of the themes of this year's Stanza Festival is home. So there have been various discussions. There was a nice discussion, panel discussion this morning about the idea of home journeys. And it was making me think about our conversation in your poems. And first of all, I was joking about it earlier, but being from the Carlisle and then living here, what does home mean to you now? And in terms of, like, would you qualify yourself as a poet of one place or another, and writing from a tradition that is associated with that?
I don't think I would really. I'm a bit resistant to kind of ideas like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I very much kind of write out of the landscape of my childhood. Which, you know, which is where it was. You know, it was beside the Solway Firth, you know, Cumbria. But and it's a place that it's a landscape that's inside me, really. It's not, you know, it's a landscape that's both external and is there, and anyone can go and see it, and people know lots more about it than I do. You know, but it's also an internal landscape that will always be kind of, hopefully, kind of laid down in me. The Firth will always be running in and out of me, you know. It will always be there as a kind of symbol and a significance that I kind of draw on. So I'm a bit, but I'm a little bit kind of resistant in terms of, you know, like where, you know, English, Scottish. And again, that's partly to do with you know, where I grew up. I grew up on the border, you know. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the Great Border City, as it's called, and I'm very, that's a strange place to grow up, a place of stark, the kind of starkening that happens in a border city, the stark divide between English and Scottish, in my case, you know, the fact that you would be identified as one or the other, and, you know, get grief depending on which side, you know, and all that's left me, you know, I don't like borders and divisions, you know, especially when you're right up against them, you know? Makes people irrational, you know, and violent.
There's something that is something we put on the place, but they're an invention, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about time, and that time is something I think we take very much somehow as a, we read it as a real thing that exists in the world, but actually, if there were no people looking at watches, there wouldn't be time, would there?
Yeah.
It's something we've invented to be able to make arrangements with one another, but it's nothing that exists actually outside of our imagining of it, is it? Borders are like that as well, aren't they? Can you read me another poem?
Keepers. The leaves fell, the potholes swilled with rain, The rain grew oily skins of ice. The ice was smashed and cast again in lumpy, half-translucencies. And then the holes were dry. Snowdrops appeared. The river seemed to clarify and wobbled like a light-filled jelly as we walked. And those six squat humdrum boxes stood. What is it we need? Water, food and shelter, love. To feel ourselves accreting a spoil of enriching, meagre words to describe one corner of an old car park incensed with crackling weeds, where we watched a moon couple move from box to box, raising the combs like golden books while the smoke-enfeebled fighters droned. All summer, I've been reading about St. Ambrose, how he lay in his crib while the bees danced over his lips, conferring eloquence. Slipping from book to dusty book, I'd wondered when he spoke if goodness had lit like honey his every cell. They were draped head to foot in white with helmets on, sexless and awesome, like post-industrial seraphim. They could have been us, attending at last to something of substance, with a taste and use obvious to anyone. But we were who we were, and turned from the hexagons of fence wire we'd been peering through, to walk back along the river by the potholed footpath the wildflowers had cracked as they sprang up, past the ruined paper mill and into town.
Did you know, I didn't know, so I was talking to some flower artist recently. Pyrus, this wonderful flower artist, and they were talking about bees, and they apparently they sometimes have a relationship with the keeper.
Mm.
I didn't know that they will. There's a story about them coming to the keeper's funeral and things like this.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things like that. That you know, if someone dies, you know, if in the house, you're supposed to tell the bees and things like that. There are all kinds of interesting things there. Yeah.
So you have written a novel. Do you feel like they're very different activities, writing poetry and writing prose?
Yeah, I do.
Do you feel more or less sort of comfortable with one or the other, and then just different activities?
I think it would be kind of, it's quite hard for me to say how in what way exactly they're different. I mean, it's quite tricky. There's something to do with just the work, the actual labour involved is very different. I was joking about this the other day with some students, you know, and if you're going to write prose, you know, if you're going to write a short story or a novel even, it just takes a long time just to actually just write it down, you know, to type it out, you know. And you have to have done, you know, you have to do that really. You have to do that first of all. You know, you have to produce 8,000 words or 25,000 or 120,000. And that's very different labour to... It's very different to a guy writing one poem, and it's very different to the kind of gathering, and maybe this is the bee thing again, you know, but the way that you gather and accumulate poems for a collection, that's very different to the way that you would intentionally generate words for a book of prose, I think.
When you're putting a collection together, have you ever sort of said, I'm going to write a collection of poetry about, and then written the poems for it? Or is it something that happens after, you know, you've written a number of poems and you think those will work together?
Maybe a year or two ago I would have said no, never. No, you know, I've not done that. But, I mean, this is the lovely and the wonderful thing about the writing life. Someone's writing life, you know, not necessarily, you know, mine or just mine or something like that, but that nothing's really set or fixed or anything. So And I, you know, I've stopped saying to my students, don't do this or don't do that. I've started to say, be wary of doing that or doing this. You know, just bear in mind that, because there's always somebody, you know, there's always a piece of writing that does exactly what you've said. Oh, I wouldn't do that, you know.
And it's wonderful for it.
It's brilliant. You know? So
you get students coming to you with examples.
It's probably taken me too long, and it just shows how kind of, you know, naive and silly I am, really. But it's probably taken me too long to think the best advice is kind of be wary, you know, rather than outright kind of admonishment and banning. I suppose that's the key, isn't it? Things will always come along and surprise. And you know, I've now written a kind of, or you know, it's getting there, a kind of longer piece that's poems, you know, and they're all poems around a single kind of character, and they still have to be found. That as soon as they become a, and this is maybe the great difference between poetry and prose, as soon as they become a demand, a chore, as soon as I start saying to myself, oh, you must write that one to go in there, I will never do it. It will never be alive, you know, it will never work.
Okay.
So I found that within that intention to kind of write a single sequence, I still have to maintain a sense that I don't really know where it's going or what's going to happen, and I just have to allow sounds, it's too passive, you know, the idea that you might allow a poem through. I think you have to kind of make place, you know, make your psyche or your soul or your brain or the page inhabitable for this thing that you're going to allow in, you know, inviting. But you still have to kind of, I still have to maintain an element of surprise about all that, and I can't actually, I'm not going to be able to finish this long sequence of poems by kind of will. It's going to be by exploration and experiment and improvisation and then arrangement, you know, rather than, hey, I've got an arrangement, I'm going to write these to fit it. It's just not going to work, you know. It has to come out, and then it has to kind of be some sense, has to be, not sense, but some shape has to be found in all that stuff.
Jacob, it has been such a delight and an inspiration to get to talk to you. I think this idea of remaining that open and being attuned to what's inside and being less controlling about it is really actually something that people should try, and it's very exciting to me to think about working in that way. Thank you.
The Weasel. So this has an epigraph from the traditional song Pop Goes the Weasel, and the epigraph is just, that's the way the money goes, the weasel. Up and down the London road, blinder by the hour, I spent as much again as we owed, white winter flowers. Crowds and crowds like fallen leaves, blown between the towers. You came in with the cold up your sleeves, white winter flowers. Screams and shouts and broken things, now you're fired. And cower under the sheets when the postman brings white winter flowers. Who'd have dreamt a little twist could turn your sweet breath sour? I tasted this when we first kissed white winter flowers. For your whole heart is half my heart is half of yours, so we're neither complete. And lie drunk in the street, white winter flowers.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook.